Well, welcome. It's great to see you all here. I'm so glad we moved from the Marshall Building. We were initially going to be in a big room. As you all know, I love little rooms like this. So this is perfect to see you all massed around us for this Ukraine event, which we've advertised as solutions to Ukraine, though in fact, all I have are 13 questions to offer you, which I will do after Stephen speaks. So the rough order is it's going to be Stephen Humphreys first on my right, and then I will speak, then Devika will speak, and we'll finish up with Mona. And then the general idea is to have a sort of discussion amongst us all about the current situation in Ukraine. I'll just make a preliminary remark, though, before handing over to Stephen, which is that, in a way, we're in the phase of a kind of moral reckoning around the Ukraine, and the we're in the phase of getting people into this room, really. So okay. Is everyone seated? And yeah, we're in a kind of a phase of thinking about Ukraine and speaking about Ukraine in sort of heavily moralistic, or at least moral tones. And it's hard to get a purchase on the situation in other ways. So we're in the phase of what I think of as outrage. And I think in a way, in this outrage phase, it's quite difficult to engage with Ukraine in a kind of long-range, disinterested, strategic, historical way. We're going to try to do that today. I mean, I entirely appreciate why there is so much outrage, and I think international law is a sort of accomplice to this outrage. It's become, in a way, a propagandist language. Applied to Ukraine rather than a historical method or a mode of analysis. So we want to sort of break through this phase of outrage, and that's what we're going to try to do this evening, starting with colleague Stephen Humphrey.
Now you tell me.
Yeah, now I tell you.
Yes, I don't think I'm exactly breaking through the carapace of outrage as yet. The events are like outrageous. So let me maybe do a zoom out thing, and by the time we get through the four of us, we will have zoomed into something much more rational and reasonable. I'll start at the outside and present the broader case and see what we get. Three points, I guess, that I would make at this juncture. I've been in the fortunate or unfortunate position of teaching the laws of war over the last term. While this has been going on, I see a number of people in my classes here. It's been extraordinary. We've been able to discuss it as it's happened in the room. It's been very educational for me, certainly. Three things that have come through for me in the course of those discussions. I think we found it uncomfortable to have to speak about this at all. And there's various different ways in which it was. First is the fact that speaking about the role of armed conflict in the context of what is an aggressive war makes a lot of what Russia is actually doing okay. It makes it lawful. So the Russian army walks across the border, starts to kill people in uniform or anybody who resists, or bombs bridges that might be useful, or raises hilltops, and all of this is legal because a war has begun. This is, of course, a well-known problem for the law of armed conflict and the law of war, known to my students as the inviolable decoupling of jus ad bellum from the use in bellum. Once a war starts, regardless of the reason, regardless of its lawfulness, lots of terrible, violent things become legal for an army that weren't legal the day before. Of course, this is awful, and we all want to say it's a crime. And so we turn to the language of war crimes. We say it's a war crime, and there are certainly war crimes taking place in Ukraine, but lots of what Russia is doing there is not war. It is not criminal, you say it's war. It's not war criminal, it's simply war. A second reason for discomfort we found is that the law of armed conflict creates a kind of moral equivalence between the two belligerent parties, as though they are both equally to blame. since they're both held to the same standards. So if we're looking out for war crimes by the Russians, we must also look out for war crimes by Ukrainians. Are Molotov cocktails a prohibited weapon, for example? Were they really parading Russian captives, which would be a violation of the law of armed conflict? After that, again, many of my students found it distressing, as did I, or even numbing, to use a word that was raised in class, that the law just doesn't seem to work. Countless reports of attacks on civilians day after day, but no real sense that any attention is being paid to the illegality of these acts. What does it say, I was asked, for a body of law that the moment it is called forth onto the international stage, it appears to be in violation? One person pointed out that it may not be the role of law, this law, the law of armed conflict, to do what it says on the tin, or not only, or not primarily. That instead we should think of it as a language of possibility and legitimacy. As well as the war waged on the ground in Ukraine, you might say, there is a discursive war, and that's being waged here in these rooms or in the media around the world. And the law of war is its language. From this perspective, I was almost relieved to hear that the Russian media has been claiming that Ukraine is faking the attacks on the theater and the hospital in Mariupol. Because if Russia wants us to believe these things haven't happened at all, they must agree that they shouldn't have happened, or that there's something wrong with them. This, I think, is relieving because sometimes it has seemed as though there is a war underway against the law of war itself, against the language of war itself. I'm not sure that this language for war that we have is the best we can do, but at the moment, it's all we have. And that takes me to a third observation about this war, which is that it's also an information war. So apparently there's a group called the Center for Resilient Information that has been examining satellite data, which they're getting from a group called Maxar Technologies, to verify the claims of attacks on civilians made by Ukrainians in order to combat the claims of falsification made by Russian media. And there is Russia's extraordinary law on fake news, which covers anything that might be true. And there is the usual propaganda war being waged by NATO and others. But there is also a background cyber war, a war of hacks and leaks. In a way, this has been the dog that didn't bark in Ukraine. At the outset of the war, The Economist claimed it would be the first serious cyber war. I think we're still not sure what a cyber war actually is, but if this is it, we haven't learned much about it so far. We have learned, however, that the United States has a lot of information at its disposal and that it is providing Ukraine with enough to aid its strategy, but without actually assisting it in targeting specific soldiers. This, it seems, is in order to ensure that they don't appear to be a party to the conflict. And so we find the law, language of law at work once again. So that's my zoom out introduction. No solutions there, but I'm sure we'll find some as we go through the group.
Yeah, we'll get to the solutions. Hello, everyone online. I see some of my students and colleagues there, and hello David, we've got the Dean of the Law School here too, Hugh. So let me just put 13 questions or so on the table. My phone never ever rings. First question is the question of sanctions, which we may well explore. How do you even switch these things off? So the first is the question of sanctions, and it strikes me that we're now in a phase of sort of stepping back slightly from the decisions that we've made in the immediate early war phase of what's happening in Ukraine. I mean, there's a lot of enthusiasm for sanctions. We were sanctioning all sorts of people, you know, football teams, warlords, oligarchs, the Russian people, the ruble, the Russian stock exchange, anything that was remotely Russian. Tchaikovsky was canceled. You know the story. It was that was the sort of atmosphere, an atmosphere that I think we might come to regret. And sanctions are part of that story. There's a history of sanctions, in other words, that we have to really think about. How successful were they? How cruel were they in Iraq and Iran or in Afghanistan? I mean, do they work? Did they work in the interwar period when we applied these vicious reparations on Germany after its so-called aggressive war in 1914? There's the question of war crimes and how that language is being deployed at the moment and whether it's a good idea to state that someone's a war criminal before you have tried that individual and what the effects on that individual's behavior might be. So as we know, Vladimir Putin, when he was called a war criminal, it does show the power of the language, threatened to cut off diplomatic relations with the United States. Then there's the question of aggression. So we have a little bit, and you know, some of my international criminal law students are here. We spent a lot of time on aggression and the Kaiser, who I have to mention in every speech I give. So we spent 2 or 3 weeks on the crime of aggression, and we really put the crime of aggression in question. And now we've got this strange spectacle of two tribunals competing over the field of aggression. We've got the ICC, which doesn't really have jurisdiction over aggression, but does have jurisdiction over war crimes and crimes against humanity in Ukraine, in a sort of competition, a sort of marketplace with this new special tribunal that's been proposed by Gordon Brown, amongst others, for Russia specifically and only. And again, the specter of the special tribunal might remind us of certain forms of Stalinism. Special tribunals were established for special purposes. And there's a relationship between the rule of law, which prizes generality, and this idea of ad hocness and specialness and extraordinariness that seems to have infected international law thinking. Then there's the question of, you know, spheres of influence. To what extent have the spheres of influence that dominated Cold War thinking and the Cold War sort of migrated into the post-Cold War period? So is it the case that Putin has just reimagined the spheres of influence that people seemed very comfortable with during the Cold War? I mean, the Soviet Union, after all, invaded Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968. We didn't intervene then. We condemned it, but there was an implicit understanding that that was their space, just as the Soviets implicitly understood that Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, and Cuba, to a certain extent, were American spaces where the United States could intervene. Then there's the question of nuclearism. And I really think that the threat of nuclear war sort of appeared briefly at the beginning when Putin made that sort of thinly veiled threat, but has sort of receded again. And yet nuclearism and the possibility of a nuclear conflagration over Ukraine really changes the mechanics of this whole conflict. And I've been rather surprised that people haven't spoken more about nuclear war and what it might mean for us, for the planet, for Ukraine, and for the Russians themselves. There's the question of genocide and the way the language of genocide has been used and misused throughout the dispute on both sides to a certain extent. Certainly the Russians seem to have used a spurious accusation of genocide as a pretext for the invasion. But the Ukrainians are now accusing the Russians of committing genocide in Mariupol. And I do wonder if the mass bombing of civilian centers, the description of the mass bombing of civilian centers as genocide, is really doing anyone any good here, and maybe having an effect on the way we think about the crime of genocide. And I'll just offer 3 or 4 more. One is the question of Western hypocrisy. What do we do about this? And how do we approach this question? So there seem to be 2 schools of thought. One is that we've got no right to accuse the Russians of a crime of aggression, since we've gone about committing these crimes in places like Iraq over the last 50, 100 or 500 years, depending on how you count these things. And then there's another group of people saying it's a disgrace that you use these whataboutery, they call it, whataboutery arguments. That's got nothing to do with the criminality and venality of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So we seem poised between these 2 rather uncomfortable sets of propositions. Then there's the question, very closely associated with that, of NATO's expansion 800 miles eastwards after the end of the Cold War. This the reminders we get that when Gorbachev pulled the Red Army out of East Germany, George Shultz said to him, in exchange for this, we won't go east with NATO, not an inch eastward, was the phrase used. What's the effect of that sort of promise 30 years ago and the effect of NATO's expansion? It's not a justification, obviously, for this horrible war that the Russians have undertaken in Ukraine, but it, again, it slightly changes the calculus in ways that I haven't quite worked out yet. So we need to think about the NATO expansion story. And then finally, there's the question of history. You know, what do we do about history? How do we deploy it? And what is the relevant comparator? So we seem to be in a kind of 1939 moment, according to the commentariat. We're in an appeasement moment. We mustn't appease Putin because he's like Hitler. And if he's allowed to take Ukraine, rather like Hitler in Czechoslovakia, he'll take the whole lot. So that seems to be one view. Another view that I've tried to put is that this might be a sort of 1917 moment. We have to decide what to do with a sort of inter-imperial war and whether criminalizing that war is really the right way to approach it, or whether that's a rather amateurish, perhaps even childish approach to great power war or inter-imperial war. Or whether the relevant moment is, I don't know, Czechoslovakia in 1968, or maybe even Cuba in 1962, where John F. Kennedy, after all, threatened to annihilate and wipe Cuba off the earth if the Soviet Union placed missiles on Cuba. Such was the strong sense that Cuba belonged in the United States sphere of influence, which takes me back to the point I made about spheres of influence and the migration of this idea into the post-Cold War, into the post-Cold War era.
Zadika. Thanks, Gary. I've done something I'm going to repeat, but I can't fold it in. Is this Cold War mentality is obviously very pertinent, and the concept that this is not, though, a Cold War about ideology, but a Cold War about geography. And I was speaking to a colleague yesterday morning who was the special rule of law advisor to NATO, which is a very important person. But she happened to be in Russia in 2013, living in Russia, and she remembers reorganizations of museums and the fact that Lenin, I'll get back to Lenin, been thinking about Lenin quite a lot recently, had been, the bust of Lenin were being put in the corner in the broom closets, and the paintings of Catherine the Great, Peter the Great, were all being centralized. And Putin, this, you know, her suggestion was, and we're hearing this about information warfare, and this has been a really long project where Putin is reinforcing this idea of greater Russia and empire. So coming back to Lenin, another thing he said was that there are weeks where decades happen. And there's no doubt that in the last few weeks, a lot has happened, and much of it has felt as if it's teetered on the existential. So implicated in this global existential crisis, relevant to the four of us, and the reason why we are taking your time tonight is really to speak about international law. And certainly international law has been caught up in this existential crisis, and also its facilitative institution, the United Nations. So I've been reading obituaries in the New York Times for the United Nations. Foreign Affairs, that old rag, has published an article. Is that entitled? The UN is another casualty of Russia's war, why the organization might never bounce back. We've read these articles before.
We've written them.
So this is an exceptional moment, but it's far from the only exception of its kind. And I've been reading recently Lawrence Friedman's compelling treatise on the future of war, a history. And that includes chapters entitled Decisive Battle, Indecisive Battle, Victory Through Cruelty, Total War, The Balance of Terror, Stuck in the Nuclear Age. And that's only the list of chapters in part one. And that takes us as far as 1962. This is where I'm going to try and dovetail with Gary's point. But 1962 is a worthy point to pause at this moment in history. Because with all this whataboutery and whataboutism, Iraq keeps being brought up. But it's worth reminding ourselves of 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Small country bordering on a great power had undergone a revolution, eventually leading to the adoption of a conflicting ideological, political, and economic agenda. And this great power couldn't accept the existence of a communist regime so close to its territory and within the region that it had long considered to be its sphere of interest and influence. That's very familiar. So in November 1961, President Kennedy launched Operation Mongoose with a view to overthrowing Castro. And in October 1962, the US had won that Soviet nuclear missiles were being shipped to and placed in Cuba. And so in response, President Kennedy set up a blockade. And in justifying the blockade, the US representative to the UN was quite specific that the crucial fact was that Cuba had given the USSR a bridgehead and staging area in the Western Hemisphere. Now, the General Assembly has recognised that acts of aggression include the blockade of the ports or coasts of a state by the armed forces of another state. This too was an act of aggression. In response, the Secretary of State at the time, Dean Acheson, dismissed international law. His argument or justification was that the power, position and prestige of the US had been challenged by another state, and the law does not deal with such questions of ultimate power, power that comes close to the sources of sovereignty. The US legal advisor Abraham Chase did raise a legal justification, and he contended that the quarantine action was justified as action by regional organizations to preserve the peace. Now, I can see some of my students here from use of force. We know that regional organizations cannot act to preserve the peace lawfully, cannot use force lawfully. This does not form a legal justification for the use of force. So jumping back to present day, we can assess Putin's explanation of Russia's use of force in Ukraine against this backdrop. Putin hasn't taken Dean Acheson's perspective. He hasn't ignored international law on the basis that law simply does not regulate major political and military crises. Instead, he's used law and legal structures. But like Abram Chase, he's taken those structures and twisted its content to the benefit of Russia's or Putin's underlying political will and interest. Putin's legal justifications for using force are actually more credible than Abram Chase were. He's used self-defense pursuant to Article 51, protecting Russia from the threat posed by NATO's expansion. He's used the argument of collective self-defense of the supposedly independent Donetsk and Luhansk republics, supporting their rights to self-determination. And he's used the argument of humanitarian intervention to stop or prevent the genocide of Russians in eastern Ukraine. Now, the problem is considering the facts underlying these legal justifications, they're bullshit. Now, using that in a technical sense, Harry Frankfurt's theory of bullshit. Now, here I am drawing on a blog written by Fayed Zabayev. And I found it a really interesting way of us engaging with it. He cites Arthur Watts. Those of us who do international law know him as, you know, one of the authors of Oppenheim, a very reputed international lawyer. Was he a legal advisor? I'm feeling he might have been a foreign office legal advisor. Luckily, this isn't being recorded and broadcast publicly. But Watts explained that there is room for the view that all that states need for the general purposes of conducting their international relations is to be able to advance a legal justification for their conduct, which is not demonstrably rubbish. Now, here, Putin's arguments don't pass the laugh test. Abraham Chayne's articles don't pass the laugh test. The fact that he's appealed to Law's authority means that he's actually set the stage for engagement. It provides a way into the conversation, unlike Dean Acheson's perspective. You know, we can imagine a situation where instead of debating international law, we'd have to be debating whether or not Ukraine is or is not a country, looking back at the historical justifications, considering the morality of NATO's expansion. Instead, we have a language where we can actually provide a label for these actions and conduct, not as policy choices, but as unlawful. And not just unlawful, and I hear Gary I quite agree, you know, there is a presumption of innocence even in international law. But it's potentially not just unlawful, but criminal. And I think these labels are important. And the labels themselves are not enough. And again, you'll forgive the fact that you've probably heard a few of us talk about this a few times in the last few weeks. I think these conversations are important. My own views are developing day by day. And one thing I've shifted from is the idea that, look, it's great. We've got this language and actually, you know, international law can't stop war, just as domestic law can't stop crime. But actually, I think it's more than the fact that we have a label. That law provides a justification for conduct, and where it's violated, it provides a justification for coercion. And I think that coercion, potentially, there's not just a role for it, but there might be a duty in this case. I'm just going to conclude in terms of this question of prosecution, and it's one on which my thoughts are not fully developed, so I'm not going to waste your time yet with them. But in 2011, Catherine Sikink, she's a Harvard professor, she wrote a book called The Justice Cascade. And the book talked about how human rights prosecutions are changing world politics. And she offers the argument that highly publicized trials of state leaders in Latin America, Europe, and Africa for human rights violations are affecting the behavior of political leaders. That hasn't happened in relation to aggression. There haven't tended to be prosecutions for the crime of aggression since Nuremberg. And so I want us to reflect on the possibility of an injustice cascade. And I want us to think about Crimea, which happened not so long ago. What of it? The reaction was muted. There was certainly no coercive response. And here we are. And I think I'll leave it at that.
Great, excellent, thanks. Mona.
Hi everyone, Mona Paulson. So I originally was excited to be last because I thought it gave me the most time, but I'm actually glad that I'm last because in some ways I'm speaking to your question of sanctions, but I am also departing a little bit from my colleagues because to me, this moment coming at it from a perspective of focusing on international economic law is one that I actually see this not as replicated in the past of actions, but actually see this as quite new. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about what is going on with the economic sanctions, particularly in the trade context, and then reflect on what this means for that particular institution, the International Trade Institution, World Trade Organization. So what we see over the past few years, this is actually beginning around the same time of the annexation of Crimea, but starting around 2016, as we see governments slowly beginning to seek to widen their policy space. And that meant a lot of invocation to exception to trade rules, to the normal trading rules and what that meant for the growth then of economic globalization. It meant that pursuant to those rules, governments could act outside of multilateral legal channels altogether in times of war or in times of emergency in international relations. So for example, governments could invoke essential security interests to impose sanctions on Russian imports, as we see through bans or increased tariffs. What we have seen just in a matter of the past 3 weeks is on an unprecedented scope and depth of these sanctions, financial and economic trade. Much of this began initially with Ukraine severing all ties with the Russian Federation. And then out of the following states, Canada was actually the first to take trade action. This is following all the financial sanctions that were imposed, trade action to seek to begin what we've slowly now seen over the course of several weeks of unilaterally yet somehow coordinated actions within the World Trade Organization to withdraw tariff entitlements, which essentially raise the costs of imports and exports, bans we've seen the United States set prohibitions on imports of energy products, as well as other products, prohibitions on investment in Russia, restricted exports of luxury goods, extreme targeting of Russian oligarchs. We've seen Japan, Australia joining Canada to impose sanctions on Russian individuals. Interestingly, just last week, March 15th, the US, the EU and its member states, UK, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Canada, Norway, New Zealand, Albania, Iceland, Moldova, Montenegro, and North Macedonia issued a joint statement. Now, why am I listing all of them? Because out of a membership of 164 countries, those 14 issued a joint statement. Now, I should say joint sanctions are not allowed within the WTO rule architecture. So they are acting unilaterally, but they wrote to the WTO General Council, sort of head organization that the membership works through to do the day-to-day functions of this institution, condemning Russia's aggression towards Ukraine and threatening to suspend further of the concessions and other obligations that they have towards Russia, including a provision that requires them to treat Russia and Russian goods and services in the same way as all the other memberships' goods and services. They argued within the context of a trade institution that they were taking that action due to Russia's, and I'm quoting here, an egregious violation of international law, UN Charter, the fundamental principles of international peace and security. They invoked the language of those security exceptions, saying that they were taking that, their actions were justified to protect their essential security interests. I want to be clear that this was extraordinary. Most of the time, these governments are not bringing into the WTO House questions of foreign affairs politics. This is seen as to be left outside the door such that they can focus on trade and investment within the context, focusing on development. So even though these institutions were in the post-war context designed to help governments facilitate interdependence, help them achieve and seek their goals of peace, when it came to questions of war or international peace and security, that was left at the door. Now, of course, as my colleagues have mentioned, there were many instances where there were conflicts, where there were sanctions imposed. And in fact, this happened throughout, you know, thinking about the Falkland War, thinking about Cuba, thinking about conflicts with Nicaragua, the United States severed relations with Czechoslovakia. So there are points throughout time where this happened, but never to the scale that we have seen. How has Russia responded? So, right after this joint action, Russia responded to WTO members about these trade sanctions. And the framing was extremely important. Russia positioned this as an economic war launched by other members. And consequently, they were in direct violation of WTO rules. There's no mention in the formal letter of Russia's responsibilities. Russia lays out the trade sanctions other members have opposed, but they don't address how those members jointly invoked essential security in light of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So whereas Davika was talking about the defense from Russia, here we see Russia's commenting on other countries' affirmative defense. Russia challenged the proposals by the Ukraine and the other members that joined of these proposals to either expel or suspend Russian participation within the WTO. There's no formal rule that would enable this to occur. It's possible the members then, if they cannot through consensus, and Russia would not agree, therefore they would not have consensus, to have this action occur, they would have to change the WTO constitution. The only other way they could do that is the members vote. Now again, 14 members, and now there are a few more, have placed sanctions on Russia in the context of the trade world. The other members have not. So it's unclear whether they would have the voting. But let me say above all that no voting has ever taken place in the WTO. It sets a dangerous precedent. And even though there have been other conflicts in the past, that voting has not occurred. So you can never say never, but it would be extremely unprecedented. So what does this mean for economic globalization? We've seen economists, Adam Posen, the head of the Peterson Institute, by the way, I have to acknowledge that the Peterson Institute is the one that's actually charting every single economic and financial sanction. So if you're interested, see Chad Bounce's work on that because it's extraordinary. It's very thorough. So the broader question that for me here is what is the future of trade multilateralism? Because it directly impacts what we know as economic globalization. So to quote from REM, is this the end of the world as we know it? I'm not feeling fine for those that know that song. Okay, Russia raises the problem with claiming to isolate Russia. It will inevitably block the negotiation process, Russia has formally stated this. So, of course, this is not just political. Russia invaded Ukraine. But it's an open question as to how the governments can continue to work. We've heard, my colleagues and I have been talking and listening to the fact that in every meeting that's going on at the WTO, members are raising the question of Russia. They were supposed to have this formal conference that they do every 2 years this summer, where they were supposed to address many issues that are important to many governments. But right now, it doesn't look like they're going to be able to have that conference. And because of the pandemic, they have not met for a number of years. This causes a huge problem for governments to be able to continue that important function of the World Trade Organization, to continue to coordinate and talk. So we know that in times of war, according to the trade institution, no legal rule will stop a state from acting to protect its essential security interests. The idea here is that trade multilateralism then, this multilateral, all the governments working together, will not bend in time of war, it will bend, it will not break. That's the hope. But nor should it stay silent, as I would argue. So some say that the fact that the governments are invoking essential security interests to sort of take it out of the context to be able to impose these sanctions that are actually inconsistent with WTO rules, but in the name of essential security interests, is evidence that in fact the system is working because there is a rule, there is an exception, and that permits them to do so. But what happens when the function, what happens to the function of the legal rules in that moment? Particularly when economic globalization, when that interdependence, those global supply chains, the building of smartphones, the building of airplanes, still needs to continue to work. And if there are no rules for what happens in that in-between, in that moment where you are invoking an exception and the laws are paused, then what happens? What happens to the planning or the recuperation, all of the impacted countries? Remember, this is not just, as we know, a strictly territorial issue, even though that would be the framing that Russia has portrayed this as. Many, many countries are impacted by this. There's records of impacting for energy prices and food prices, fertilizer. Russia provides a significant number of commodities that affect everything that we all use around the world. And particularly in a time of pandemic, many economists have raised concerns about what this would do for certain countries. So to come back to that idea about the WTO as enabling governments to coordinate, be transparent about their trade policies, there's no requirement for this in security context in times of war. That obligation for transparency is suspended. So if we put a pin in the moral and political justifications for isolating Russia through trade actions, through the trade institution that it necessarily participates in, we should then consider some of the recommendations on the history of sanctions, like Nicholas Mulder, who's at Cornell, who focuses on the history of trade sanctions. And he has written a couple of pieces, I think one of them in Foreign Affairs, talking about putting attention to the people, to the everyday, those that are impacted by energy capacity and energy prices, rising prices. So I think for those issues, then we have to think about what do we do in the absence of the rules. So my argument today and my observation, I hope that my colleagues will talk to me about, is that one of the solutions are thinking through the impacts of the Russian war, or even the global crisis of pandemic, climate change, which are so actually interrelated to what is happening, is to how we break apart from that ideal of multilateralism, this idea that governments were meant to come together and all operate in consensus. Because it's clear that as far as the relationship between security and trade have gone, they are no longer strange bedfellows. So if governments don't coordinate, we risk seeing incredible fractures. And I think this is where now we come back to, you know, the repeated concerns about, is this the end of our international organizations? Because I hear the same thing about the World Trade Organization. This is the end of the World Trade Organization. This is the end of governments working together. We're going to see fractures, which will lead to groupings of governments. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you're warning me. Okay.
I am warning.
That's fine. I mean, I think what we have here is a concern between increased interdependence and governments at the same time failing to appreciate the impacts of their sanctions, being able to understand when those sanctions will unroll, being able to understand the full impact of the sanctions because they are so unprecedented, because it's never been done in the state of increased economic globalization. And that is how it perhaps is distinct from other times, not just a major nuclear power, but also one that is deeply embedded within complex global supply chains. That is unprecedented. Without any coordination or discussion, remember again, due to security, that is all suspended. Governments, but particularly the people living in all countries around the world, are forever going to be three steps behind. So what can we do? We need to think about how we operate in the absence of these formal legal mechanisms. So governments have to then begin to think of it. If they're not going to agree to strong legal binding rules because they're operating in times of security, that in at least informal mechanisms, this comes up to the soft law options. How can we think past a perfect sense of multilateralism and embrace the roles that could come in between, not just thinking about the roles of persuasion or coercion on governments, but how to find something in the middle where they can redefine transparency or interdependence, even in times of war. I'll stop there.
Great, thank you. Thank you. Are you okay down there, Manuela?
Yeah.
Okay, great. We've got lots of time for questions, comments from the floor. Felix, you're already.
Yeah, I have one immediately on there now. Okay. I guess I wanted to push
back. So we're going to collect some questions.
Is there raised the question of whether that's the end of international institutions? I wanted to ask whether you think maybe the end of institutions created in a certain spirit of the 90s of like this neoliberal world that we have seen fractures in the WTO before, with mostly, I would say, with the upper body not being a place at the moment, and the Biden administration even being unwilling to, again, name candidates. And I wonder whether with like also possibly upcoming, I think at the moment, a bit keyed down Chinese, US rivalry, probably being the death nail in the WTO as it was, whether we will, what's your thought on that?
Thanks. You're okay, go ahead. Yes, fine.
So it is unprecedented in the sense that the absence of the appellate body, you saw that even though the United States had concerns with the appellate body, they were finding workarounds. Governments were willing to still participate. The panel process was still operating. Of course, the tensions had been rising between the United States and China were escalating, and that showed the inability to be able to accommodate different developmental approaches, right? Different approaches to development. That is one about how to reform the rules, and itself is extremely challenging. I find that this, the operation in times of security, is quite different. And in fact, what I would draw to is the fact that the United States had already been very keen to use the idea of security to be able to act unilaterally because it felt like it didn't need to, or there were good reasons to operate outside of this. But at least then there was some commitment to still act together, to be transparent. This would simply be a halting of all the books, and that to me is concerning. But of course, we all still need everything from one another. We're still heavily interdependent. That hasn't changed. So if we see an end to economic globalization, we have to take seriously what would happen. What would happen would be what we've seen, this emphasis on resilience or strategic autonomy or self-sufficiency that we've seen sort of the governments begin to use to bring everything back home. Adam Posen, who's an economist, has said, but to do so, then we sacrifice efficiencies, we sacrifice choice, there's consequences of price. So it would be a question of whether governments are willing to do that exchange for being able to have that ability to act alone. We'll be seeing a decrease, not necessarily to the 90s, but to before the invention of these trade institutions. Now we're really coming back to the period in the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, one really big framing device. I'm so hypnotized by this typing as ever. How are they translating me this time? One big framing device here is the question about whether this is new or not. And this comes up every time there's a major crisis. I mean, Davika touched on this. Every time there's a major war, somebody stands up in foreign affairs and says the UN's over, or international law's over. Or when I arrived at the LSE, I think the first sort of six public lectures I saw were called The End of Sovereignty. So this war is really about the rebirth of sovereignty, if you like. And perhaps every war is. You know, we keep thinking it's over, and then it revives itself. Iraqi sovereignty, Libyan sovereignty, Ukrainian sovereignty. I mean, if we're talking about anything here, we seem to be talking about the idea that a state or the people in that state should organize their own affairs, you know, a classic sovereign idea. And if we think of sovereignty as somehow being juxtaposed to globalization, then that becomes even more interesting. There's a sort of revival or rebirth of sovereignty around here. But Philip Jessop, an international lawyer, once said something along the lines, you know, beware people bearing the gifts of novelty. And I think that's been the case in almost every major crisis I've encountered while teaching at the LSE. Okay, other questions from the floor? And yeah.
I have also a question from Paulson. I didn't quite understand the security aspect. So in the WTO framework, can you use security so if the war does not impact the country directly, you still use security as an excuse to kind of deviate from the rules? Because I thought that maybe in a trade context, security would mean something that concerns your economy internally.
So this takes us back to questions from Gary about nuclearism, because so it has been done. We saw the Falkland War as an example, where we saw Canada and Australia and the European communities join to bring sanctions. And Argentina made that claim, actually, that this is just a regional dispute. You know, other members shouldn't be involved. I think at the time when the governments first began to act, the characterization of why they were acting was, I think, in the context of this concern. Putin had just raised this concern of nuclear war. Many countries, I think, at that point, instantly found the great need to have this be an escalation. I think the other framing now is one of simply the fact that governments, the producers, the consumers, everyone is so deeply interconnected that because of this, you know, two political scientists, Henry Farrell and Abe Newman, have talked about the weaponization of interdependence that we're seeing here. And due to those concerns of how this is being used, when one government begins to act this way, even if it's a territorial issue initially, it's no longer one, because the sheer interdependence of this has made it a security concern for all. And that's, I think, the logic they want.
Can I just add to that? I'm sorry, because it is quite interesting that sanctions themselves, if we try and fit them into a legal framework, and I'm going beyond the WTO measures here, they're actually a form of countermeasures.
Yeah.
And you're only allowed to take countermeasures if you're an injured state. So I just, this might not be interesting to you, but I think it goes to the same point. And so it's actually quite controversial under international law whether any state apart from Ukraine at the moment is an injured state. And it is sort of asking us to test the boundaries of agorognas, for example, and yet the extent to which we are all injured. And I think that, even if I might bring this back to international criminal law, goes as far as asking us to question who is injured, which community is injured at the moment. Is this a crime against the international community? And I'm going to get really controversial here. So, ready?
Stop the recording.
There was an event at UCL, and colleagues got in a bit of trouble as between themselves. There was a debate about whether, you know, there's selectivity and why do we care more about Europeans? And then there was a big fight, and you know, someone ended up saying something like, well, of course, Europeans care more about Europeans, etc. We know the terrain we're in. But can I just say, this is Europe's problem. And so when I'm thinking about who should prosecute, for example, I actually can see a real argument that Europe should create this court, that this is a European problem, and that there's nothing selective about, you know, Europe setting up a court for a crime committed within Europe. Now, I've gone well beyond your question, but it comes back to this question as to how are we defining the injury here? Is this a crime against the international community, and so therefore something that should be addressed at an international level by the General Assembly only? You know, how do we work this out in terms of constituency?
Can I just say one thing also? I'm so sorry. You know, it bears in mind to know too, this really speaks to what Davika was just saying, that for some of the countries, like Canada, it's almost political because the trade on what those goods were revolved with was so small. So the big trading partners to support to what Davika was saying is the European Union members. They're the ones that are greatly trading on certain of these goods, right? Especially energy, oil and gas, as is China, was not imposed sanctions. So there's, you know, it really matters. This is a strong political decision as well as an account.
I mean, these I'm just going to bring David in a minute, but these invocations of humanity and international community worry me. ICL class I've heard over and over again, but this is a kind of Carl Schmitt point, isn't it? About, you know, he who invokes humanity cheats, you know, so who is humanity? We always seem to be on the side of humanity whenever we invoke it. But there's another phrase of Otto Kirchheimer's that's been sort of going through my head since this all began, where he said every regime needs its foes, or in due course creates them. And I do wonder if somehow there's a memory of the Cold War circulating here, and that we lost our foe, the Soviet Union, and we spent 30 years in a desperate search for new foes. We found various foes, Serbia, Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and we pushed further and further eastwards, and eventually we found the foe, and it was the same old foe again, but in new clothes. It was Russia, the latest enemy of mankind, the latest pirate. David.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that all you wanted to say?
We know what the next James Bond's going to look like, right? So we all came here, guys, for solutions, right? And I'm not sure I've heard any. So, and maybe I have heard them, and I think about it a little bit more deeply. So it seems like there might be two solutions and split on the panel, so I wanted to push you on it a little bit more. So on the one side, there is an idea that the solution is found in the rejection of international legal language. That international legal language squashes complexity. And when we squash complexity, it's much more difficult to find a solution to something so complex as this. And then the other side of the fence, which is split down the panel in the middle, I think actually, we have the idea that no, law matters. There is real legality here, real illegality, and there is bullshit And when we identify real illegality, we then find duty. And with duty comes action. And with action, the solution is boots on the ground in the Ukraine. NATO boots on the ground. So I just wanted to push you on that. Is that right? Is that a fair characterization of where the panel splits on this?
Like a question mark when you need it, wasn't it? Solutions.
Yeah.
Well, this is something that we'll all have our perspective on. Mine is that the solution is not boots on the ground, and certainly international law doesn't require use of force to be the solution. So I just certainly would like to clarify that that's not. But the solution is a political question, not a legal one. Law can provide, I suppose, some mechanisms and techniques. But that is a political question in the end, which of those is opted for. I'm aware, though, actually, I do want to explore the idea that there is some obligation under law to take some form of action, but I do want to clarify that I definitely didn't mean the solution has to be force.
I think you're putting me in the category, David, of a person who thinks that the legal language is squashing other languages, and I think that is in fact where I belong. I think that's the case. And I think about the Iraq War as an example of that. We spent a lot of time talking about the legality of the Iraq War. Seemed like a very important discussion to have. We all became very excited about that as international lawyers. But I do wonder if we shouldn't have been talking about how we proposed to reconstruct Iraqi civil society after the war during that period, instead of talking about Security Council resolutions. So there's an example, or a possible example, of a moment where law generated some pretty significant losses. And I think at the moment we're in that phase again. I think international legal language, not the language that Davika speaks so nicely and well, but the language that's being deployed by the political class is a sort of dangerous language for us at the moment. It's the sort of language that forces us to declare that Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. It's hard then to come back from that and say, actually, maybe we need to negotiate with this person in order to end this ghastly war. So I do worry that international law does a great deal of damage at certain moments and also opens up certain possibilities. So one of the solutions that I've been sort of exploring is the idea of neutrality, and we can think of neutrality as an international legal technique or gesture. So it's not all downside.
I guess you're putting me in that camp as well.
I'm putting you in any camp. I'm just identifying a divide.
So what's striking to me to some extent is for the past 30 years, the West has been jumping into various conflicts for various reasons, for various justifications that don't sound very plausible in the main to international laws. And now we, in fact, have a very strong case for international law for boots on the ground, actually, for collective security. And it's hardly being spoken about at all. Instead, we're hearing a lot of stuff about a special course to try aggression and war crimes course that may or may not, that seem very unlikely to come into being. And so you do find yourself wondering, well, what work is international law doing here? It seems to spend a lot of time creating conversations that are a little bit beside the point. I don't think it's as simple as, you know, international law is our tool to some extent. So the way we engage it activates the sorts of politics we want to see happen. So at some level, I feel like it's not for or against. It's how does one engage and what does one put through it?
Got a question here, but Davika, you want?
I'm so sorry. I was going to say briefly.
Sorry,
But Gary poached me with saying Iraq, we should have stayed and potentially reconstructed. And I just want to either misinterpret what you were saying, but use it anyway to come back to David. And Iraq
it was then the self-defense justification turned into a duty to impose democracy or a right to democracy, which does not exist under international law. To impose democracy under international law with some pretense at some justification under international law. And actually, that was incredibly, I think, damaging, the idea that it should, that international law has that. And again, this comes back to this idea of, well, under whose banner then do we do things like that? If we're going to impose a regime on another nation, one or a few states have no justification, right, duty under international law to do that. That, if anything, you know, the Security Council could do it, but certainly they didn't in that case.
I am going to bring you that policy, but I have to speak directly to that point because it goes to David's question too. I think that the difference between you and I at the moment in this conversation is that you think the danger lies from what you are rightly describing as misuses of international law. They took self-defense and they turned it into some justification for democratic states going in and invading other countries, that kind of thing, which we could pull apart doctrinally. I think my point is that just ordinary use of damage. So that would be the sort of difference, that even legal arguments have dangerous side effects. It's not just the misuses of international law, it's the use of it that's the problem. Mona.
I want to say that this is sort of a qualification or clarification as well. I'm not trying to argue that because of the economic globalization, we need to not be taking these actions. Of course, governments make those choices. And I agree with Debbie here that in that extent, it's a political question. What I do see concerning is the fact that with this imposition of economic sanctions and financial sanctions, that there is no complementary discussion about when, for how long, for the extent. A lot of it is in the realm of politics. And there I hope that governments will use law, not to impose decisions or to requirement, but in the way of the ability to create a mechanism to communicate, coordinate, to build those discussions. There I see it as very important, not only because there are people's lives that are being impacted both in Russia and in Ukraine and more broadly for the rest of the world, but also because it sets down the line. We're seeing awareness already of, and this comes back to your question earlier, about the precedents that it's setting for things that were already happening at the same time. So I share with Stephen a concern for climate change and the impacts of this happening. And we see it in real time. And if governments are more inclined to connect climate with insecurity or exceptionalism, that we're moving further away from those legal structures that would enable governments to actually coordinate, which I think is an important part of thinking about concerns that impact everyone, whether we think of a community or not. I think these are coming down the line. So
let's treat this as a bit of a sort of town hall moment then, where we hear from you and we'll start with your question or comment. And then bring in others.
So you kind of answered the question out like, so I was just volunteering in Hungary last week, just with the Ukrainian refugees, and it's, I feel like it's being there, it's more devastating than it seems like the news. Like actually having mothers bringing 6 to 10 babies through the border is actually in real life, kind of overrides all this legal language. And I don't have a legal background, so maybe that's, but if that question really answered part of my question, but the question then stands, up to which point can this happen where something that bad to humanity, to Ukraine, to life happens that international law, humanitarian law, or something needs to step in? Like, where is the line legally, or is there a line where if that's crossed by Russia or by this whole situation, then it is truly then justified to do something?
That's
not much.
Great.
Can we do something? Do you give any thoughts? Or
Do you mean force?
Yeah. Or any type of reaction. Yeah, like any type of like stronger reaction that in that is.
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, so I was kind of thinking about the first intervention. There was a comment about how when we talk about this from a use in parallel perspective, it almost seems like we're saying this is okay. This causes a discomfort. And I have this feeling as well. I share this feeling, but I kind of don't understand why I have to. Because if I imagine myself in an exam situation and there's a question, general public international law, and I hope it will not be the case. Assess the effectiveness of Russia's action in Ukraine. I would have a section on the use of bellum, and I would probably say it's unlawful. And then I would have a section on, let's say, one specific act on the use in bellum. I would say, okay, maybe actually this was lawful. And overall, my result would still be this is unlawful. So in this setting, I would not feel discomfort. But then you kind of do. And I wonder, so there's been a lot, using this frame a lot, of international law as a language. It always seems like it is one monolithic thing. But I'm wondering whether it is more of a means of communications with different languages therein. And sometimes we have false ranks where, for instance, one word like necessity means one thing in a certain language, the use of bellum, and causes a certain feeling in this language. But another one in another language, Sindelo. And I was just wondering, do you think that, is this like feeling of discomfort, this kind of clash, is that inevitable? Is there any way we can deal with this? Can we still use the language of Sindelo to talk about the horrendous things that are happening and condemn them while not causing this uncomfortable kind of tension with the other language that we also need to use up for? Say this aggression
overall. Good questions on the exam. but before you answer it,
So I would like to ask the panel to expand upon one point that was only very briefly mentioned among the 13 questions that Professor Simpson has suggested about NATO expansion. So if I understood that correctly, you said that of course NATO expansion in itself is not a justification for what Russia is doing, and Russia tries to justify their actions by the supposed threat that the NATO expansion has posed to it. But it puts things in a particular perspective, right? So I'd like to ask you to expand upon this point a little bit, because as I said, I was just asking this question to myself. Okay, so we. Supposedly, we hadn't expanded NATO to countries like Poland in 1999. Would Poland not be in Ukraine's place today? So Ukraine would have stayed in the Russia's influence zone, so to speak, very firmly. And would, for instance, Poland would try to join structures like NATO. Would Russia not then say that Poland's willingness to join NATO is a threat to Russia's and their friends' national security? And when do we draw this line? Because out of countries that hadn't joined NATO then, we see Belarus, which is a puppet state of Russia. We see Ukraine, which is invaded by Russia. We see Moldova, which has part of its territory controlled by a pro-Russian force, or Georgia, which was also invaded by Russia in 2008. And where is this line? So for instance, if Poland hadn't joined NATO, if it was taken into the Russia's influence zone, what then? Would Russia have pretenses to German reunification? Would this pose a threat to Russia's national security then? So is this Russian expansionism even satisfiable in a sense? I don't know myself, I'm just asking you. Sorry.
Sam.
I have a question. I have a question about sanctions as well, it has more focus on kind of the political, social elements of it. I'm wondering what you think about the framing of sanctions as collective punishment and whether you think it's too soon to be thinking about potential human rights implications that the sanctions can have. Because if you look at sanctions in other countries, for example, in Iran,
said quite doubts any impact on access to medical care, and whether you think it's even possible to think of that at this point in the crisis, or whether that's more of a long-term concern. And I guess how that goes into thinking about the effectiveness of sanctions in ending the war, if that's what they're trying to do with that.
Let's start taking some of those questions. You want to?
Yeah, sure. That's a wonderful question, Susanna. I'm just going to, I guess the bit I want to focus in on is you've questioned this notion of international law appearing as a kind of a monolithic figure, which you misinterpret in some way, as well as an agent in history. And what struck me coming back in a way to David's question is that actually, of course, the split isn't so much maybe between genders for a long panel here, but rather between those of us dealing with war and criminal law on one hand, and I think Mona to some extent dealing with economic, international economic law on the other, because the meticulousness with which the structures of economic law are followed and attended to contrasts rather sharply with what we see happening all the time when it comes to the law of war and international criminal law. They simply seem to be serving very different functions in the way we think about our world and what we think is important and where we need to keep our promises and, you know, debts must be paid, or we can cross some of these territory that we don't have. There's a sort of a vast distinction there. And so if you want to be effective, if you want solutions, well, you need sanctions, because actually that's where you're going to be able to mobilize and really bite and really hurt. And one of the fascinating things about what's happening now, I think, is the power of the banks, right, in actually making things hurt in Russia, the power of social media. There's all these ways in which Russians, ordinary Russians, are being required to sort of look in the mirror, take account of that in a way that couldn't have happened to anyone. And that's extraordinary. And that's also a function of law. I mean, it's not law as we talk about it all the time, but it's law that needs to be talked about.
So I think it's difficult to know the full extent right now as things are happening. Do I think that they should not consider the human element of sanctions? I think they should have thought about it before they even imposed them, right? This is something that they immediately need to think about. And the question is, you know, are governments explaining that? I mean, do I think that sanctions are there to stop Russia? I'm not sure if that's what we know. And we know from history that, you know, again, drawing from Nicholas Mulder, his work on this, one of his main arguments of the book was that actually they didn't create that they didn't stop war from happening. They were themselves an act of financial war for them, right? And I think this is why the sort of the need to think about them and to actually ask governments to think about, okay, for how long, when would it stop? How much further can we go? I mean, you know, Stephen's right that the immense freezing of assets, even the central bank, all the reserves now going after the oligarchs, now going after individuals, but really trying to stop Russia in its tracks. And it's, you know, and this is the question of how long can that go? And now trade is the other side, right? Because trade is what gives them further income back in. And they've already stopped what they had saved because Russia had a considerable amount of assets saved in various places, and they've cut all ties to that. So it's really about getting them to be at the most vulnerable position. That in tandem works with the military, the sort of armed conflict that comes along with this. But at this point, there's not clear when it's going to end, which is, you know, a legitimate question. There should be these processes, and that's why I sort of want to see governments begin to talk about that, to think about how it's impacting people. Because it absolutely is, right? You have to think about human contact that's happening.
No, I want, actually, I've been told to take some questions from the screen. Somebody just came on, so when are we going to be able to have our questions answered? Questions. So there are five questions on the screen, but I can't actually see them. So maybe if we take Malte's question while this is happening. Yeah, brilliant. So we'll sort of get on top of these questions while you ask your question.
Thank you. I was wondering about the employment of genocide, as you alluded to in your questions as well. I think there's a whole range of interesting questions about that, but particularly the reliance of the ICJ provisional measures on the genocide convention, interesting enough, it's not really about, it doesn't seem to really be about genocide. So I'm wondering what the panel thinks of the way the ICGJ made provisional measures to stop the war based on the genocide convention, because it seems like, maybe in a teleological way, it seems such a seems to make sense because it's so much in the spirit of the fundamental norms of international law and the UN Charter. So I'm wondering, what do you think? It doesn't make sense, even though it seems a little twisted to reach to this result through the genocide convention. Is that a valid way to pursue this, or do you think it's rather harmful?
How should we deal with these questions? I mean, they're up there. Russia's a global power, permanent member of the SCE. What would have to happen to bring the Putin administration to justice? Okay, well, that's a question. Question to Davika and Gary, do you believe something? Do you believe the temporary exclusion of Russia from the UNSCE is both feasible and desirable? And then question, I think Gary mentioned earlier the idea of a special tribunal for Russia. Does this sort of proposition not seem dangerous? Finally, I feel that we're slightly disadvantaged here online. Nobody reads us. Well, we are reading you now. We're reading you loud and clear. So let's have a go at some of those questions. Any thoughts on those?
Well, sure,
and
then I'll hand over to you. Vanessa, I think, both raised the Security Council and Russia's position on the Security Council, and Lena quite sensibly was like, seriously, what is the chances of Putin being prosecuted? I'm sorry, Lena, I can't see your question now. I think that's essentially what you were saying. It's a global power. I have not yet concluded what I think about that, because I think it's highly unrealistic that he's going to be prosecuted anytime soon. But I don't know. I still think that there is merit in setting up a tribunal, in collecting, you know, the evidence, in getting the structures in place, potentially in an in absentia prosecution declaring that he is a war criminal. And I think if his job description on Wikipedia in the future is not former president of the Russian Federation, but guilty of the crime of aggression, I think that is still potentially worthwhile. The question, Vanessa, about do you believe the temporary exclusion of Russia or its voting rights from the Security Council is both useful and desirable? Again, potentially my view is controversial. I think Russia must stay on the Security Council. I think Russia must maintain its voting rights on the Security Council. I think that the Security Council is there to maintain a balance of power in the international legal order. I think the UN is there not to prevent war, but to prevent world war in the end. And that's not to say that I think the balance of power should now shift to the General Assembly. And so because the Security Council is paralyzed, it means we can't have this efficient body. We have to now go to the broader body and work with the General Assembly in that respect.
Yeah. We are going to finish at 8:30, by the way, just to clarify. So I keep getting asked this question about whether Putin will be prosecuted. This, as a matter of sort of ethnography, is a question that the media is very interested in, because whenever I get a call from, it was the World Service yesterday, and they asked me about war crimes trials, you know, I mentioned Carl Schmitt. They're not interested in that. They're not interested in really anything I have to say. And then they asked me the question again. Well, will Putin be, never mind Carl Schmitt and Otto Kirchheimer, will Putin be on trial anytime soon? So I sort of adopt a slightly different hat. I become a different international lawyer in that moment. And I take the question seriously, and I'm going to take the question seriously now. And the answer is that you just never can quite tell. This is a law of unintended consequences, international criminal law. So really, I think in 1943 at Moscow, was there a serious prospect of the
major Nazi war criminals standing trial? Hard to say. It was a kind of gesture that was made by the Allied powers. They hadn't won the war yet, and they were sort of planning a trial. Would it ever happen? Would Hermann Göring really end up on trial? Adolf Eichmann was living his life happily in Buenos Aires as a working in a photo shop, going to work each day, having participated in the Final Solution as the head of the Gestapo unit responsible for the Final Solution. He pleaded superior orders. The only order he refused to obey was the order to stop killing Jewish people in Europe. It looked as if he would die in Buenos Aires, but he was in fact abducted by Israeli agents, taken back to Jerusalem, and stood trial and was executed. President Milosevic, it seemed impossible that he would end up on trial anywhere. Pinochet? Well, he came to London to have tea with Margaret Thatcher and to seek medical treatment and ended up being subject to extradition proceedings at the House of Lords. Now, all of those were unexpected. So it's impossible to say that Putin certainly will not stand trial. So that's one sort of answer to that particular question. Excluding Russia from the Security Council, I think exclusion is the wrong way to go here. I think the relentless and self-righteous punishment of the Russian people and the Russian state is likely to have somewhat contradictory effects on international peace in the end.
Malta's question, the ICJ intervening in this genocide ruling and speaking instead of, about provisional measures with regard to use of force, worryingly perhaps a Pyrrhic victory, I suppose. I mean, so I've got mixed feelings about this, I guess, much in the same way as one might about a potential trial of Putin at some point. You're welcome. It sounds wonderful. It does what you want an international court to do when you celebrate. And then you step back a little bit and you notice, well, actually, nothing has changed here. And you worry a little bit then that, well, perhaps to be an international court and stand your ground in something as important as this and be shown to not have any real effect isn't such a good thing. Perhaps something to be said for stepping back a little bit and being a bit more circumspect and understanding why that's how we characterize what WIC is doing. So it's a complicated question. I don't think, and in a way, time will tell. But I'd love to be able to embrace it in a way that I don't quite feel is appropriate. NATO expansion, I just want to pick it very slightly. I think you very nicely picked out of what Gary said a nice inversion that he'd introduced there, because we are all busy with Russian expansion. And it's perhaps good to remember that this does begin with a form of NATO expansion. In a way, the answer to your question probably lies somewhere between Finland and Estonia. But I can't help fearing that Ukraine used to be Habsburg Ukraine and Russian Ukraine. I have a line right down the middle. And it was, as somebody pointed out to us last time around, the borderlands. That's what it means, the borderlands. To some extent, Ukraine, I feel, has been treated incredibly poorly over the last 10 years by the EU and NATO in particular. And when Biden steps forward, and you remind us very nicely here of the original implication of that inch of territory, and says in response to the invasion of Ukraine, we will defend every inch of NATO territory, there's something horribly cynical in there, something very easy about the way NATO seems to be riding high on it. It's really enjoying the limelight. And the new members that are flocking in, Finland is clearly one of the directions one of the follow. And a kind of a reversal to the comfort and familiarity, as Gary was saying, of a Cold War politics. So we've been sort of struggling in the dark for the last 30 years, and there's something about the ease with which so many actors fall into position that is a bit concerned.
I just want to point, because I really want to address your comment. That's where our hearts and minds really are and should be. And so I'm about to address Malta's question on the ICJ, you know, because it's really a bit of paper, what's happened there. And so for international lawyers, you know, the roar of the crowd, the grease paint, a colleague, very famous colleague of ours who's a specialist in terrorism, we won't know her. It was really sad the other day because he was like, no, it was all about me and terrorism. Now you, Gary, and Tamika and Mona and Stephen are suddenly in the limelight.
Connor,
this is a lot of chat about nothing in some respects. The ICJ judgment included, what was the court to do? And it's actually David, yesterday, a conversation a couple of days ago with David, he alerted me to one of the declarations. Because, this is an interesting moment, and again, who cares, for international law, where we get to sort of really unpick and unpack categories, and there's an energizing and invigorating aspect for the law to really be confronted with issues like this and how we deal with them. And the court's role is one of them. What was the court to do? What was the Russian judge to sentence? Oh, funny that. What was he to do? But there is an interesting question that comes in. But there's also these moments like Benouna, and this is from David alerting me to the fact that one of the judges, the Moroccan judge, explains that he voted in favour of the order in this case because I felt compelled by this tragic situation in which terrible suffering is being inflicted on the Ukrainian people to join the call by the World Court to bring an end to the war. He actually didn't agree with the legal position. And that's really interesting, but he actually expressly said that, where the law ends and actually, real life steps in.
To come back to this as well, the interesting thing was that in the beginning, when this first happened, right, so when Canada was one of the first, Canada didn't argue in legal terms pursuant to the trade rules. They argued about the violation to the people and the violations of international law that's happening on the ground in Ukraine. And so I think in this case, what's interesting is it is, as Stephen's right, it is such a different, I'm looking at it in such a different way about what's happening in my rules. But so what could happen? Well, what we might see is Russia bringing a dispute to the WTO against those countries that have filed these invocations. It would be a very interesting one to see how they would characterize what had happened and their responsibility, which in the previous dispute in 2014, which Ukraine and Russia were already at the WTO over transit restrictions that were imposed related to the initial invasion of Ukraine in 2014, there they refused to characterize their responsibility. Refuse to provide any evidence. So we might see a reversal where actually governments would have to defend. The other question is how can, aside from the coordination that I think is crucial right now for governments to actually be talking about what they're going to do about these sanctions and for how long, is to think about what they can impose. And this is the progressive sort of view that's coming out from several colleagues. Mulder, I think, is in my head because of Foreign Affairs, the piece he wrote. Is about thinking about how the trade rules need to address, how governments need to be thinking about these trade rules if they want to help subsidize countries that are harmed and dealing with crisis, if they want to be able to address, concerns with food prices and food security, and being able to have questions about certain elements, certain measures that governments are going to have to take to protect their people, to be able to address this that may otherwise be inconsistent with the rules. And how you do that is actually talking to the governments and talking, having coordinated. We very much didn't see that in March 2020 when the pandemic hit and governments instantly began taking trade action to be able to address the pandemic. And there, one of the key lessons from that was early coordination, early discussion would help protect the vulnerable countries. I think that's something.
Well, these are really painful matters, but it's important that we're not alone with them. And it's just great for us on this panel as colleagues to be in a room full of such engaged and intelligent students again. So thank you. And I now draw these proceedings to a conclusion. Thank you, everyone on the screen as well, of course.